Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, Justin Downs returns to reflect on the recently concluded ski season in China and to discuss his new role in Hokkaido, Japan. With a career dedicated to advancing winter sports in Asia, Justin has been instrumental in the infrastructural development of ski resorts in China, contributing significantly to the country's readiness for the 2022 Winter Olympics. In this episode, Justin provides an overview of the performance of the skiing season in China, talks about the world's largest indoor skiing resort in Shanghai, and compares the ski markets of China and Japan. Enjoy.
You're right. It is the largest indoor ski dome as of today. I'm sure somebody in China will open one that's one square meter larger sometime in the near future. But that was a massive project, both in the undertaking just to get it designed and built is one thing, but the kind of the financial horsepower that needed to be behind it to get it done. This was an initiative by the Shanghai Pudong government to activate other parts of Shanghai to move more of the population away from the center of the city and set up infrastructure and develop new economies and just, you know, new places for people to live without living on top of each other. So this was like a social development project by the Shanghai government to inject some more life and passion into the suburbs of Shanghai.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
So, Justin, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Todd. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for your kind words.
Okay, so where are you in the world today that we were recording you from?
Normally, you get to talk to me from Beijing, but today I am sitting in beautiful, snowy mountains of Hokkaido in Hanazono Ski Resort in Niseko. So one of the most aspirational and highly sought after destinations in the ski world.
Yes, I was going to say my condolences. That just sounds terrible. I think a new role has brought you to Hokkaido. Can you tell us about that new role?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was very fortunate through my company Axis to have been asked to step in and oversee the operation and strategic development and expansion of Hanazono Resort, which is one of the four resorts of Niseko United. And so I've kind of seconded myself, let's say. It's a under sufferance, of course, to come and spend this winter here in Niseko and make sure that all the good things that were done previous to me are continued, setting the high standard of service and guest experience, but also to kind of set the next path forward for what the next generation of Niseko and Hokkaido skiing is going to look like. So I've stepped in as the, let's just call it the chief operating officer of this resort, seconded by Axis to look after this project. And I've just been going backwards and forwards between Niseko and Beijing for the past few months. So I'm here now and kind of looking after the shop. And it's been a fantastic winter.
For those of you listening who are hearing the same level of desperation and sadness in Justin's voice, please look below. We have a GoFundMe arranged to try to support Justin.
Please.
Through these difficult times of what he's going through. That sounds amazing. I'm so super jealous. And we've had you on a couple of times before, but for folks who didn't catch the previous episodes, tell us a little bit about Axios and the work that you've done with skiing in China.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned at the top there, I've been running this game, let's call it, this company based out of Beijing since 2007. And the original pretense for setting up the company was to deliver turnkey solutions to the mountain resort industry, at the time ski resort, but that's since grown into other types of mountain adventure tourism, golf, and other mountain year-round activities all across the country. But the company itself offers everything from master planning to feasibility studies, business planning, detailed design, project management, construction supervision, and management of the destination when it's complete. We set it up as a management company to run as a turnkey solution. But at the outset, back in the 2008, 2009, the developers of that generation really thought that they wanted to be the operators. They also had no idea how to be the operator. So we, in essence, became a consulting company to help them to do it. Now the shift seems to be coming back in China, where the developers are saying, okay, we should just be developers and we'll let you operate. So now we're back into the operations game as well.
And for those of you who know what's going on globally, even just here in North America with all the news and everything, I think I said Axios, and that just it tips you off to, like, and it is a news platform that I follow, and obviously I've had to look at it far too often recently, trying to keep up with everything going on. But it is Axis, not Axios. My apologies.
I'll let it slide this time. It's okay.
Thank you. It is well earned, because you try to find as many bipartisan, decent, media sources as possible to keep up with things these days. But yeah, as you talked about, it's interesting how you talk. Trying to do it all, and then realizing kind of what you're good at and who else is good at. We actually dive into that a lot about, when we're talking to brands expanding to other areas of the world, and to really take a self-diagnostic and a little small shot of humbleness, and know what you're good at and know what others are good at, and really kind of lean on that Sherpa of taking a brand overseas, or to really kind of use the experts at your disposal who are the best at what they do, so that you can continue to focus on being the best at what you do. And this has just been a narrative that we have heard so often when it comes to, and I just think it's the part of the recipe of success globally around so many things right now. You just can't be all and everything to all people. But yes, I'm glad you said that. Now, it is early March, typically in the Northern Hemisphere. The ski seasons are starting to wrap up. Now, I am in Western Canada. I know that we have less than a month here, about where I'm at anyway, of a ski season left. How has this season gone for China? How has the ski season gone this year for China?
Well, I think from a visitation standpoint, I think it's been extremely strong right across the board. I think the weather conditions, this started off a little bit mild in early November, when a lot of the resorts in the Northeast are starting to try to get going. I think they were delayed by about a week in getting open, but then it was pretty strong. They say snow production conditions from that point onwards. And I know that the resorts, certainly around the Chongli, Hebei, Jilin, Heilongjiang area, have been record numbers. And so too has Xinjiang. So the Altai region has seen enormous growth in visitation this year. In the north, in the Northeast, there's been some pressure on pricing. I think the customers are kind of demanding more competitive pricing. So I think that the developers themselves are getting a little bit more squeezed on margins. They're still being asked to deliver a high quality product, but with less money. So I think, they're going to need to redefine the way that they're going about things. But the good thing is that the public still wants to engage with the sport, and the visitation numbers are up. The length of stay of customers going to the ski resorts is longer, which is great, because that just helps the local economy right across the board. But probably the biggest increase that we're seeing, obviously, is not necessarily just in the winter, but it's all year round for the 60 plus indoor ski domes around the country, which are just thriving at the moment, just because on the back of the 2022 games or the Asian Winter Games, there's just been such a spotlight by the media shining on winter sport that 750 million people kind of south of the snow belt are itching to get involved. So, it's all part of the pathway. They're starting skiing in the south in an indoor ski dome, then they migrate to the northeast or the northwest. Then eventually they migrate overseas. So it's all about keeping retention, keeping them engaged, keeping them interested.
Yeah, it's wild when you can. I mean, tourism by and large is a north-south game, and it is awesome to see more northerly winds with regards to travel and why they're coming and what they're looking for. I love this for China, frankly. I think they are primed for it. I think geographically, they're in a great spot. I think economically, they're in a great spot. I think it is a sport that fits them very, very, very well. And then on the back of that, you mentioned the snow domes, right? You were involved with the launch of the world's largest indoor skiing resort in Shanghai. Tell us about that project, the state of indoor skiing in China, and why that's such an important part of the growth of the sport there.
Well, yes, I mean, you're right. It is the largest indoor ski dome as of today. I'm sure somebody in China will open one that's 1 square meter larger sometime in the near future. But that was a massive project, both in the undertaking just to get it designed and built is one thing, but the kind of the financial horsepower that needed to be behind it to get it done. This was an initiative by the Shanghai Pudong government to activate other parts of Shanghai to move more of the population away from the center of the city and set up infrastructure and develop new economies and just, you know, new places for people to live without living on top of each other. So this was like a social development project by the Shanghai government to inject some more life and passion into the suburbs of Shanghai. And it's certainly done that. And it's around 60 kilometers outside of the city, but it's on the Shanghai subway. So it's easy access for, you know, well, actually it's easy access for 40 million plus people in that greater area with no other real opportunities to experience this type of product anywhere nearby them. It was done at a very high quality. It was quite sensitively done toward environmental balance against what you're taking for the environment versus what you're giving back. It's a very integrated experience with hotels, a water park, shopping mall, ice rink. It's a destination resort within a building. It's really very impressive. So it's a fully controlled, single ticket type of experience. You could go there for, you know, an afternoon with your girlfriend or your kid, or you could go there with a bunch of friends on a weekend and make a party out of it. It really is it's like Disneyland for winter sport. It's quite an amazing thing. So the visitation there has been very strong. It started off a little bit slowly, just based on the time that it actually opened, at the time of year that it opened. But it's had a very strong winter, and there's such a huge population of skiers and snowboarders in Shanghai. Actually, the largest ski and snowboard club in China is based in Shanghai, so it's very highly frequented. They go out there with large groups in the evenings, and then later they'll obviously go off and go up to overseas or to the northeast or northwest. But you know, it's a good experience. It is indoors, so it's limited by its size, you know, but it is controlled by the climate, so you know what you're going to get. The snow quality is good. The infrastructure is very high quality. The management is doing a good job. The ski school is delivering high quality teaching experiences. The food and beverage is good. Their customers getting good value for money. And I think that's what the market needs.
I want to ask you a question about ski passes. It's funny. I ran across an interesting video that was diagramming and explaining some of the historical economics of how ski resorts have transitioned pricing and passes and why. And I used it to actually send to the GM of the golf resort that I'm a member at, being like, hey, have you guys ever looked at these types of economics with regards to golf memberships? And a lot of it was, they were just talking about how and why ski hills have really leaned in on the year long pass and like the seasons pass versus the day pass. And really just to, you know, kind of give that nice base of revenue to start and to avoid dependencies on weather and things. And now we're talking about ski domes, but those also come with and I wanted to even ask you, what does it cost to produce snow inside of a ski dome? How actually expensive is that? So talk to me a little bit about how in that region, and even interestingly with snow domes or indoor ski resorts, when it comes to the finances, when it comes to sitting around and talking about ski passes, if you do, I don't even know if you do, but I'm assuming that this modeling has to be a part of what it takes and understanding the market and whatnot. What does that look like? How comparable is it to the West?
Well, if I know which presentation you're talking about. I assume you're talking about the Vail Epic Pass and.
Yes.
I just watched this actually recently myself. I mean, it's not new information, but there's always interesting new ways to see it described.
I love the way it was presented, though.
Yeah, me too. We don't have anything like that in China, although the Epic Pass is being sold in China, and the Ikon Pass, which is their biggest competitor, which is Alterra, their biggest resort competitor, is also about to start selling their passes in China to capture the interest of the Chinese skier who aspirationally wants to go overseas, and they want them to come to their resorts, of course. So this product is highly attractive to everybody around the world. China doesn't necessarily have such a product at all yet, because there really are very, very few, and you can count them on less than one hand, of multi-resort owners. And so they say there's 700 resorts, there's probably 695 separate owners, and they're all trying to protect their own piece of the pie. What I see is going to happen in China is that's going to change. I probably predicted it on one of these previous podcasts, but I'm still saying that there will be some consolidation going on in the Chinese industry, whereby this will open up the opportunity for these type of pass product like the Epic or the Ikon Pass. Right now, it's all just about competing with each other, not collaborating to drive the market up and to get more people involved, engaged, and retained in the sport. The China market's quite immature in that. North America is the leader of this type of product. There's obviously been a lot of resistance by some people toward this product. You know, I think in that presentation, that graphic you're talking about, say 10 years ago, it was 65% of people were buying day tickets and 35% were buying seasons passes. Yes. Now it's completely the opposite.
Yes.
They've made it so that you cannot afford to buy a day ticket, but they've made it so it's almost a no-brainerly affordable to buy a seasons pass. Like if you're going to go skiing more than three times, then buy a season, more than 3 days, buy a season's pass. And so what this does is, I mean, it's a genius idea if they can continue to keep the public engaged with it, is they get billions of dollars up front. And that's the most expensive time of the year is for when a resort is ramping up, hiring staff, building new lifts, starting to make snow. All of the heavy costs are at the start of the season. They pretty much banked all of the revenue that they need to cover their entire global network of resorts expenses by this pass product. And then the customer then feels, okay, I've already got the pass. It's relative. Let's consider it's free now. I've already paid for it months ago. Then they'll come and they'll spend money on food and beverage or retail or ski lessons or their hotel products. It really is a fantastic product. China doesn't have it yet, but I see that it's something that needs to happen in the future.
Okay. How expensive and costly is it to produce snow? Because obviously indoors you have to do that.
Well, there's two components to it. It's water, and depending on where you are, the cost of water can be very high, or depending on where you are in the country as to the supply of water or the government's tendency on what they want to charge for it. Water is probably the biggest single variable factor. And so the government typically will say to a developer, say you need to budget how many cubic liters of water do you need to produce the snow that you require for the winter? And then that's all you're going to get. And then they'll set a range of 10 RMB per square meter. They probably need 5 million square meters of water to produce snow, depending on the size of the resort. So it's really just a game of multiples. It's how many cubic meters of water and how much per liter are you charging? And it varies quite broadly across the country, depending on the amount of water available. Then it's electricity. But the good thing about the Chinese resorts is that most of them are using the most modern technologies for snowmaking. So the snowmaking systems themselves are very efficient and user-friendly on the electricity side. So automation and temperature control and the types of snow product that's actually created from the machines is far more advanced in China because the newness of the industry as compared to the technologies are being overseas. But to answer your question, is it expensive? Yes. It's probably the single biggest cost that the resort has aside from labor cost is snowmaking cost. And they all need to have.
Okay. I don't know. I'm just filled with weird questions today. I apologize. So I'm curious also, like every so often when you have a refrigerator or a freezer, the frost builds up. You have to unplug it. You have to empty it out. You have to let it thaw and drain. And then let it dry. And then you plug it back in and let it go. Even our local public pools will shut down for 2 weeks a year at minimum if they're indoor so that they can empty the pool, empty the water. They can clean it. They can perform maintenance. Is there a de-thawing and then a refreezing of these indoor ski resorts? Or do they not have to worry about that? Can they just continually run?
they would typically only do that if they had some major failure in the system. Because if they, most of them have floor or refrigeration systems embedded in the concrete slab of the indoor ski domes. The only reason why you would have to get rid of the snow is if you needed to replace those refrigeration pipes and the cooling system. Aside from that, yes, you're like any ski resort, actually, you're sitting on a block of ice. But that's kind of what out here today. I mean, we probably got five meters of snow, but we're sitting on 2 meters of ice. And then on top of that is the snow that you're skiing on. The same thing applies inside an indoor ski dome. So there's a little bit more replenishment going on. So they will discard, just because you cannot continue to ski on the same snow endlessly without the snowflakes themselves decaying and it being unsafe or a poor experience. So they need to replace the snow, but not down to the concrete slab. So, you know, there's always a standard operating procedure or a business interruption plan if you need to close down sections of it, of the ski dome, a ski dome at one time. But typically, unless there's a failure in the system, you wouldn't need to do that.
Is it a clear roof or is there lights?
Lights, yes. In Shanghai, so where you it's like...
be open 24 hours.
Yes, yeah. And I'm sure the demand will get to that point at some time. Right now, it's only open until 10 o'clock at night. But, you know, there's no reason. I mean, they ski in outdoor ski resorts 23 hours a day in Korea. There's no reason why eventually they might not want to do that in China as well. But so far, the demand is that people are perhaps a little bit more interested in going out for long dinners than they are about skiing 24 hours a day.
Have the outdoor ski resorts adopted the other activities to improve the tourism to that place like we have here with mountain biking? Because it has been such an incredible boon to resorts to be bringing and just the paths and the cars and the jumps and the whole thing and just that downhill mountain biking experience. I mean, those chairlifts are barely taking a month off on the shoulder seasons before it's right back into, and the lines are just long and it is full again and people are zooming down the hills all year round. Does this happen in China yet?
It's definitely becoming more of a trend. I think the developers, firstly, they didn't really believe that there was much of a summer business, depending on what part of the country they're in. In fact, some of the ski resorts were far more popular in some parts of the country, like in Changbaishan. So Jilin province was and Altai and Xinjiang were way more popular in the summertime ever before anybody thought that you could offer skiing there. So they already have built-in tourism products, whether it's sightseeing or hiking or scenery or agritourism or this type of stuff. But other resorts, say like in the Chongli area outside of Beijing and in other parts of the country, they've kind of caught on to the fact that, yes, I spent a lot of money to build this infrastructure. I need to figure out how do I make it work 365 days a year. So they're a little bit slow to the game. And the resorts that had made the first steps into investing into infrastructure, like mountain biking, like you said, or luge karting, or even golf driving range, or tennis courts, or trail running and hiking, those ones are doing extremely well. The Taiwu, my example was Whistler back in the late 80s, early 90s, was much more of a winter destination than a summer destination from an overall visitation standpoint. Now it's much more of a summer destination than winter, as far as pure volume of people that come to the town, not necessarily that go up the mountain, but come to the town. And so Taiwu, which is a resort north of Beijing that was kind of one of the venues related to the Olympic Games, now sees more than double the amount of visitation in the summer than they do in the winter. And that's largely because of the exposure that they get from the winter, but the public is not the whole public is interested in being in minus 15, minus 20 degrees and hurtling down the mountain on a set of skis. They just want to experience the nice, cool, clean mountain air and the flowers and stuff. And, you know, I still believe firmly that the evolution and the success and the viability of the mountain industry in China is going to come from the summer, not from the winter. But the winter still will be a very powerful driver.
Okay, so we've seen you did some media on the Asian Winter Games, which recently wrapped up in Harbin. And I've been to Harbin in the middle of the winter, one of the coldest places I've ever been.
Yes, indeed.
Tell us about that event and the popularization of winter sports in China and across Asia.
Well, this is the second time that Harbin has hosted the games. I think, obviously, China also has hosted the last summer Asian Games, and they did it in very big scale in Hangzhou. And it was a great success and really accelerated people getting involved in sport in general. The push kind of started well before then, because obviously we hosted the 2008 Summer Games and then the 2022 Winter Games. As soon as the 2022 Winter Games were announced, the government was really promoting getting people activated into sport, lifestyle, wellness, domestic tourism. So the acceleration of the 2022 Games is really what kind of set this country in motion as far as a desire to be healthier, happier, and get out in nature. China did extremely well during those Winter Games, but they did amazingly well in the Asian Games. And I don't have the TV viewership numbers, but from the just anecdotal comments that I've received from media colleagues is that the viewership of the Asian Winter Games was unbelievably high. And so people are just genuinely interested and intrigued about the success of their athletes. I mean, they dominated the medal count and is setting themselves up for probably what's going to be a very surprising and good result in Italy in 2026 for the Winter Games. It's, you know, these types of large scale events not only are good for a place like Harbin, it's already rich in winter tourism and sport, and it's got its own culture with the ice festival and all this type of stuff. They're not hurting for visitation at all, but it's going to obviously solidify their space, their place in tourism or winter tourism and even international winter tourism for many years to come. But it's also kind of activated or triggered so many more people to say, go to the indoor ski domes in the South because they saw how successful and what a fun industry it could be. So it's done wonders for the industry in China, but it's also doing great things for these other smaller nations that would not have registered on anybody's radar that they even have an interest in winter sport, like Thailand or Vietnam or Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, all of these kind of weirdly exotic non-snow destinations that are now breeding skiers. Here in Japan, it's amazing how many Southeast Asian people are coming skiing compared to 10 years ago. So I think this is also the same thing that's happening in China, how many people from Southern China are going to Northern China, but also how many Southeast Asians are now aspiring to get involved. And big events like the Asian Games really help that.
Streaming of the movie Cool Runnings is on the rise in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
By the way,
I'm sure we'll see a few Asian versions of this type of Cool Runnings or Eddie the Eagle type of movies coming up in the future.
Yeah, that's right. If you don't know what we're talking about, Google it. If you're traveling to Harbin in the winter, pro tip, the most important thing you're going to pack is a flask. Thank me later. Now, given the scale we're seeing, is it fair to characterize China as a mature market, or do you think it's still an emerging market?
I would say it's still very much an emerging market. I mean, it's the domestic tourism is very, very strong. I think the problem that we grapple with in China is it's emerging because the retention rate is very low. So there's so many people in China, and still less than 2% of the population have actually tried skiing and snowboarding. So there's still a lot more to go. The number of 2% of 1.4 billion is a meaningful number, but is only meaningful if they keep doing it year after year. Eventually, yeah. you'll run out of people. Yeah, something. Yeah. So my prediction is that we'll hit 30 million ski and snowboard visits in China this year. And by 2027, it will be the largest ski nation in the world, which will put it over the US, which is in the low 50 million numbers. But I think our biggest threat to it becoming from an emerging to a mature market is retention. So it's really getting people to stay with the sport and progress and make it their family passion year after year. I think also the government is still early on its platform of trying to improve kind of the social network in second and third tier and rural communities to allow people to be able to afford the time and the money to get into the sport. So they're so aggressively and actively pushing people to engage, but there needs to be some balancing of affordability versus availability. And I think that it's a little bit unbalanced is that the supply of infrastructure does not necessarily meet the demand of the public yet. So there's a lot more infrastructure that still has much greater capacity. So I'm saying all of these things by comparison to perhaps other more mature markets. China is a serious market, but it's still in its maturing stage. It's not there yet.
Okay. By the way, I think my math was off. I think it's more like 70 million, 2% of 1.4. Anyway, yeah. Yes. I'm sure
I knew the 30 million number. You were doing the calculation.
Okay. Yeah. I'm 2% of the divide by 50. Is that right? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, if for anybody who wants to land base me in the comments, please do send me a comment. I'd love to hear about it. Last, I know you got to run or you got to luge or you got to tuck, but any other exciting developments to touch on in China ski market?
Well, I think the key, we've kind of already touched on some of them already, but I think the growth of the northwest part of China and what that's going to do to perhaps international interest in skiing in China. So we're talking about Xinjiang or Altai region. It really is an exotic and interesting place to go just as a tourist. But the skiing and snowboarding, the snow quality, the scenery, everything about that is actually destined to be of international quality. It is already good and will only improve. But we don't see much international interest in skiing in China. It's mostly a domestic market. But Altai is definitely going to do that. And perhaps other areas like Chiang Mai-shan, which has got more of a Korean or North Korean feel to it. So I think we're going to see some changes of the customer profile of people coming overseas for a bucket list type of experience in China. I think we're going to continue to see the growth of large scale events like the Asian Games and World Cups and World Championships and Continental Cups, all of these things that kind of bring the growing talent pool of Chinese athletes. The Chinese government is still going to push for a lot of these competitions, which will continue to shine a spotlight. I think we're going to see a lot more AI related kind of technologies to improve the safety and the efficiency of the overall experience, that facial recognition and injury response or any of this type of stuff. I think we're already starting to see quite a bit of this. And also the indoor ski dome, I think, is still, no pun intended, the tip of the iceberg. There's still many, many cities that will want and can sustain indoor ski domes. I think this is like golf courses were a big part of a tourism destination community in any part of the world, including in China. These ski domes need to be a part of the school curriculum to get, and not just ski domes, but ice skating rinks, any type of winter sport facility. We're going to see more and more development in this category over the next couple of years.
Okay, let's telemark into the last talking point right before you enjoy an Apres Pod hot chocolate. Now that you're working in Japan, just compare the China-Japan skiing markets.
They're very different. I would say Japan is definitely a very mature ski market. There's no question about that. But it's been declining over the years across the board, mostly because Japan is a declining and aging population. The infrastructure is dated, and that by comparison to China, the younger generation is definitely interested and engaged in getting into the sport, and the infrastructure is all relatively new. So I think those are two pretty big differences between the two countries. I think China, we have more than 700 places you can go skiing. Japan is still quite large, but has been declining over the years to now less than 500. China is still developing a lot more beginners. Like, it's a beginner-focused market, whereas Japan is much more of an advanced ski market. As I mentioned before, China is still focused largely on domestic tourism, whereas Japan is seeing massive international tourism from all over the world. Every language is being spoken in the resorts around Japan. It's quite amazing. I think China is doing a lot of stuff. The government is funding a lot of the growth in China, whereas in Japan, it's all pretty much privately funded. So the government is, as I said before, very buoyant on this sport in China. So they're putting lots of capital behind it. I think China and Japan they both grapple a little bit with affordability. Japan is obviously affordable for international skiers, one, because it's cheaper in general, but two, because the currency is relatively weak. China's got trouble, as I mentioned earlier, about trying to make it affordable to extend the stay for the customer. So there's some differences there. And I guess the obvious one is that Japan is famous for powder snow, and it is relentless and endless here. As soon as you become a half-decent skier, you want to ski in powder, and Japan is the place to go. So China doesn't necessarily have that product, which Japan does. So we're seeing a lot of Chinese people coming to Japan now because they've reached that level and want to have that next level of experience.
Always a bluebird recording. Justin Downs, president of Axis Leisure Management, thank you very much for coming on the show. Once again, we really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Todd. My pleasure.
Okay, as usual, everybody listening to the audio-only podcast, don't forget we have the YouTube version on the WPIC YouTube channel. And vice versa, we are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you want to reach us, reach out to podcast@wpic.co. We would love to hear from you, from me, and from Justin, and from everybody at The Negotiation. Thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.